Online all the time. southernfm.com.au.
Get a load of tech. Upload, download, reload with TechLoad. Updates, news, tech experts. Get tech ahead. Drive Tech. 6 to 7 every Wednesday with Sandra Spencer here on 88.3 Southern FM.
Welcome to TechLoad. Sandra Spencer here and lined up for you for the next hour, tech headlines, news, info, music and insights on the world of flying, technological changes and disruption, innovation and perhaps better quality of flying and flight paths for the future. Your captain will be with you shortly. Southern FM and you're tuned in to TechLoad. We have a warm welcome for James Nixon, who has been flying for 31 years with both the Boeing and Airbus. And we're going to talk about technology, and there's nothing more technological than an object flying in the sky. Hi, James. Our captain, if you could please introduce yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, live direct to you from the left-hand seat in the Starlight Lounge, this is your captain speaking. Hi, Sandra.
Thank you, Captain. Oh, ex-captain now. Do you still enjoy flying as a passenger?
I do. I love flying in the A380. I'm just addicted to it because it's got lots of engines. It's very safe, very comfortable, and it's got 135 computers all working.
135
computers. Only three of them are Microsoft.
And
which ones break down, you reckon, every day?
Can we say Microsoft? That's a lot of computers. Like, do you actually know them by name?
Well, yeah, I did. Halfway through my training, I got sick of trying to make making a list of all of them because each one's got a job to do. Mm-hmm. Whether they're using flight control computers, of which there's five, keeping the flight controls moving, updating 20 times a second. Then there's the navigation computers. Then there's ones that move the fuel around, move the hydraulic fluid around, which is the blood of the airliner, and run the engines and make the engines work properly, generate the electricity.
We don't have time to go through 135.
That's right.
But if we go back in time at 31 years at the very beginning of your flying experience and training, how many computers did you have to deal with in the cockpit?
That's right. In the 727 Boeing, there was only a handful. And we used an Amiga navigational system, which was what the US Navy uses to talk to their submarines. And every now and then, there was about six Amiga towers around the world. There was one down in Sale in Gippsland, and eventually they started turning these things off, so much so that when we'd fly to Perth in the middle of the night, the cleaning lady in Mexico would unplug plug in the vacuum cleaner, and all of a sudden the big red light had come on the flight deck and we'd have no navigation as we're heading off into the Antarctic. So but the good part is when you're going to Perth, you know that Australia is to your right.
It used to be a very long flight. Was it 7.5 hours?
In those days for us, it was about 3 hours. About 4 hours, 15 minutes into the headwinds. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you pick up a big, huge tailwind on the way home. 3 hours, 45 coming home.
Actually, the 7.5 hours was, I think, from Queensland, from Brisbane to Perth.
Yes, Brisbane to Perth is a long one, especially into the headwinds, and also Sydney to Perth, particularly.
Have you flown a Concorde?
No, but I've sat in the right-hand seat of one parked. But
parked? Yeah, it wasn't in flight.
No, that's right. It was sitting on the ground. In fact,
I didn't know that. You told me this story earlier, yes. But I actually thought you had flown in one. But that's sitting in it when it's parked is not really
the story. And it's so tiny. I've been in a few of them, actually.
And how many did they have?
They had six of them for British Airways and six of them for Air France until they set fire to one. There's one actually, a spare one in Yeovil in England, which is where they had a prototype one.
Is it operational?
No, it's in a museum. And they also have the front half of one in Bristol, also in a museum. So they had all the versions that they used as prototypes. Mm. But there was actually only 12 of them made that actually flew.
Mm. And do you think we'll, in the future, have anything like a Concorde again?
I don't think so. I think the cost of hypersonic and supersonic travel is just so great. To go out into the atmosphere and then fly around the world in 90 minutes or less, to go from London to Sydney, and the problems we have with people saying that they don't like the noise of the sonic booms, it's too restrictive and too expensive. And now if the world is actually getting better at FaceTime and Skype. And once we have real-time document sharing for teleconferencing, we'll get a larger number of business class passengers. So really
true.
It's looking at the leisure market, and the leisure market's just not big enough or expensive enough to pay for those expensive flights.
So if we speak about the leisure market, will you be booking a flight to Mars?
I don't think so, because my job is risk management. That's what captains are. Risk managers.
Do tell.
And I don't want to go and see a rock, quite, you know. I'd much rather send the new version of David Attenborough.
Well, what's the risk that you see a rock HD? And that you're not interested in rocks on Earth? What's the risk?
Well, that's it. I mean, there's a fantastic rock. I don't know if you've, because you can see it when you fly down to Tassie. There's a fantastic rock in the middle of Bass Strait, you know, but no one's bothered to go down and have a look at that. You know, there's a rock called Skull Rock.
You're not expecting to see anything else. I mean, they are making more discoveries, like water.
Martians.
I was going to say that, but thanks for that.
Good resort, I'd go there. But the problem is radiation. I mean, that's one of the reasons I retired early, is because I was flying over the North Pole, and, you know, you can't beat radiation and sunspot activity. So eventually you've got to say to yourself, you know, do you really think it's worth putting your life at risk, shortening your life for the exposure to go to places like the moon and to Mars just for entertainment value?
No, I was going to say you're not into it for the thrills.
No.
If we go back to the Concorde, I remember the time when they stopped operation of the Concorde, and I thought that was because, what I was reading was because they thought it was no longer commercially, economically viable.
Well, it was. That was really the reason. In 2003, I was actually flying into London and parking in the Concorde parking spot when I was with Air Malta, and the engineers used to, who looked after us, or actually serviced the Concorde as well. And so they told us about the fact that there was, since 9/11, and 3-hour delays for security to go into airports for flights going to America, the 3-hour security at the airport was longer than the flight. And so it defeated the purpose of going to the airport and jumping on the plane and 3 hours later getting off in New York.
And you really needed that much time to go through security?
3-hour security. So it's just not worth it anymore. So the lunchtime flight lost money. They couldn't get passengers to do that. And then they said, well, if I'm going to go over at night time, I might as well book a sleeping compartment in a 747 and go for 6 hours and have a nice experience, have a nice meal and have a sleep.
People are looking because, for comfort.
Yeah, the Concorde seats are tiny. I mean, it's like being in an office chair. You know, it's really amazing to see how tiny those seats are.
But mind you haven't flown economy for a while, have you?
I believe there's a lot of people in the, when you turn right in an airplane, if you turn right, there's a lot of people back there behind that curtain. It's not pretty.
Right. And highlights and lowlights of your career. Highlights?
Well, getting to fly into all these airports around the world and to fly successfully and not having lost any passengers. I mean, it's important to actually have finished your career with the same number of passengers that, you know, came on.
So
the
your
front.
Safety record's been excellent?
Safety record's excellent.
No deaths?
No deaths, but I actually did lose an engine. That $10.5 million blew up an engine over Zagreb one day. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Venice for a few days, holiday while they replaced the engine.
As a reward.
Yeah.
But that
$10.5 million
wasn't because of your flying.
No, I saved the day. Saved the day.
Why?
Well, because, like, you know, they didn't die, did they?
Right. And so what have been those critical moments where you've had to think fast? What have been the most challenging times in the cockpit where you've really had to be at your absolute best for safety?
I think twice a year, every airline pilot earns their salary. So whether it's to do with meteorology and getting caught out with weather conditions that were not forecast, or whether it's to do with a problem with the aeroplane or a computer problem or a problem with a system, a ground system that's given you false information or a wrong flight plan or something. But twice a year you earn your money, and you earn all of your year's money in 1 or 2 minutes in those days.
Wow. And that's what all the training is for, and recruiting the right type of person. What type of person do they look for to recruit?
Someone
pilots?
Who doesn't want to spill the coffee, and someone who's very level-headed. And what we look at hiring pilots for, one of the big things we check them for is for pattern matching. So we're really good at pattern matching. So we can tell you what's in a picture, and we can see when something's been taken out of that picture and added to it.
You have to have an eye for detail?
An eye for detail, but being able to pick patterns is what's important. And
Because with 135 computers in the cockpit, like in these times, you'd want to be checking patterns on a whole lot of different screens.
Yeah, being able to see what's wrong and what's missing, that's important. And finding pilots is a huge problem. We need 180,000 captains in the next 10 years, mm-hmm. and I reckon there's probably a chance of making 100,000 captains worldwide in the next 10 years. So we're mm-hmm. we're desperately short of captains mm-hmm. and first officers. So at the moment, we're having a big training problem. And I was in a conference in Singapore last year, and of course, if we're having problems with trying to find captains, we're having troubles trying to find cabin crew as well. And the cabin crew...
Do you still need to be a certain height?
Yes, you do, because you've actually got to be able to reach up to those overhead bins. You'll make it.
But not if you're in economy. You have to do a lot of things on your own in economy, I'm sure.
That's right. But you still got to be over 5'3" or whatever it is. But there's one thing you got to do, and that's open the doors. And they have these door trainers. So the cabin crew are qualified on each type of door for each type of aeroplane they're working on.
And sounds very complex.
It's very complex, but it's actually a mock door. But they've actually got to open it. They've got to open it normal mode. They've got to open it in an emergency mode. Where the explosive system opens the door and it drops down the slide. And you've got to also open it in emergency mode when the system's failed in manual.
Oh, okay. That's a lot more involved than I thought.
Yeah, and you've got to demonstrate to do this. Funny part is we don't have enough door trainers in the world to train, and then every year they have to be requalified on door trainers.
Wow. So they've gone that's a niche in the market. That's an opportunity. Is that something you could be interested in?
Well, not me, because they've come up with virtual reality. And they've actually got approval to do every second year as a virtual reality. And so we saw at this conference, this girl put the virtual reality amazing. Goggles on and headphones, and they did a ditching. So on the TV screen, we could see what she was seeing, which is opening the door at sea level in the water. And when an airliner goes in the water, they're designed so they won't sink. So if they landed properly in the water, they won't sink. They just sit there. Mm. And so she went through. We could see her open this virtual door. And when the water sloshed up, she actually jumped back.
Yes, exactly.
Because she believed real. It's so real to her. She believed
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And you've had virtual reality training, have you, with your flying?
Yeah.
I suppose you've already been trained.
We call it simulators. We use the simulator.
How does that work?
The simulators, the pilots do their simulators every year. We do two licensed simulators. That's every 6 months, your license is up for grabs. And then every other 6 months, you're doing training. So an Emirates pilot will do four sim sessions a year. And within 5 minutes of sitting yourself in and taxiing out, you believe the scenarios. So whatever scenario, you're completely convinced, whether it's smoke, fire, fumes events or hydraulic failures, all this. And so we test all those emergencies. And that's all virtual reality.
And you feel like you're absolutely experiencing that condition at
completely,
that time.
Completely. Yeah, and you come out of there after a four-hour session, you are completely wet through. Your uniform is wet through with stress and tension. It's quite amazing. But it's probably the best way to learn.
It's probably a relief that, it wasn't real, but then it is so real that it's the right type of experience and training to have. So that's a great thing that's happening with technological advances in the airline industry for training.
And so now using these virtual reality simulators for cabin crew, it's a whole different experience. So we're going to be doing the same for engineers because we've got the same problem. Mm-hmm. How do we get enough engineers and get them and train them in the time allowed? Mm-hmm. So we're going to see more and more of this virtual reality in the future.
And do you think that I suppose it's a big question you can't really ask, but there's increase in flights. I suppose the probability is that we'll have more accidents. But will this type of training potentially help alleviate potential disasters in the future?
It sure will. And we've got right now, there's 5,000 planes up there. There's 120,000 of these things a day flying around the world, according to the Australian newspaper 2 days ago.
And so this is very different to the time when you started your career and you had, was it 5 computers or 15 computers?
Yeah, that's right.
There weren't that many planes flying right
there weren't
that
many
time.
Planes. Now we've got thousands. And and every day on the North Atlantic track system, we've got 2,000 planes pretty much take off at the same time in America. And they fly across the Atlantic and they land in England and Europe first thing in the morning.
So what about the systems for air traffic control? I suppose they've also increased in their technological advancement.
Not only do they use simulators to teach the controllers, because normally a controller takes a few years to get qualified, we've actually got to compress that. We've got to make air traffic control areas where they're protected areas. Mm-hmm. So the really high quality air traffic controllers are used for approach and departure control. Sector controllers, where they're flying along by themselves, we can get a lesser qualified person to do that. We can use systems with alarms on them. So if a plane strays off an airway, it sets an alarm and it notifies the controller that there's been a plane diverting off the airway. And to get them to that point, we've also got simulators to do all that teaching for them as well.
So you've mentioned a lot of different technologies there, but you know, what major technologies do you think have changed the work of a pilot?
Particularly engineering. We used to have a flight engineer on the 727 when I first started flying for airliners at ANSET. So they had a guy who sat between the two of you, two pilots, and they were in charge of the engines. Their hand came up underneath yours and they modified the engine, made sure it was perfect. They looked after all the 23 aircraft systems with another panel on the right-hand side. And so then the A320 came out, and the A320 came out with only two seats, pilot and first officer, and 12 systems pages on the computer screen. And each one of those systems you could look through and monitor yourself. And the pilots are now doing the job of the flight engineer. So you could probably say the first person who lost their job due to artificial intelligence was the flight engineer in a Boeing 727. Mm-hmm. The second person who lost their job in AI and robotics was the garbo. When we were kids, Each garbage truck had a driver and two guys to take the garbage truck and garbage and put them in the back of the truck. Now you have a driver who's got a robot that empties people's rubbish bins.
That's right, and it's not always working all that well. Sometimes there's garbage and the bins, like, on the street.
That's right. And so,
disaster.
But we don't... It's funny, no one cries about the flight engineer or the garbologist, because those people have actually lost their jobs due to technology and we've done nothing about it. I personally find it interesting, coming from an industry that has seen huge amounts of technology changes in the 31 years I was in it, to see all of a sudden in the media they're all freaking out and all the lawyers are freaking out because now they don't need paralegals, because a computer can go through the court cases much faster than a brand new intern. But really, in the aviation industry, we've been seeing this happen, evolving over the 31 years.
We'll be back and we'll talk more about the technological advances and changes that the airline industry has faced.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
And we're looking at all the technological changes, past, present and future, with James Nixon. James, what effects has technology had on the passengers?
Well, firstly, filling up the planes. In the old days, we used to have travel agents selling tickets, and they'd make a paper ticket and they'd send it to you in the mail, and it's all that drama. So now we've got computerised ticketing, which is really, really fantastic. We get e-ticketing, goes straight to your phone. You don't even need a paper ticket anymore to check in. It's really fantastic. But also, we fill the planes up by doing that. And now we know, 2 years out, when we open the flight, we start through some automatic artificial intelligence gates. We look at it 18 months out and we see how many seats have flown, are full already.
Oh, you might cancel flight paths or flight changes.
Well, no, they'll just change the offering. Mm. And so they say, okay, well, normally this flight, it's 18 months out, we would have expect to see 2 business class and 4 economy sold. We haven't, so we're going to change the offering. Now, the airline industry is the most amazing industry in so far as that no two tickets are the same price. Unless you're buying two tickets together, you've got no idea. So if you want to have some really good fun, go up and down the plane and ask the person, every single person, what did you pay for this ticket? And it will freak you out, because some people are doing it really, really cheap and other people are doing it as part of a very expensive package.
Even within the one class.
Yeah, within the same row across the plane. And if you're buying the ticket from New Guinea and you go on and buy the ticket for that flight, or you're buying it from India, the currency conversions, etc., it's much cheaper or more expensive from each different country. So where you buy your ticket from is geo-blocked when we're buying the tickets. They know where you're coming from. And so we're massaging that offering all the way through and changing it. And then all of a sudden you'll get the other end, when we're getting close to the end of the flight going, the night beforehand, they're sometimes overbooking flights because we know passengers
I've been in that
You've been in an overbooked situation?
Yes, in the Middle East.
I was in the Philippines trying to get out on a staff travel ticket, which meant that, you know, if there's any tickets after the thing's ready to go, 40 minutes before departure, all the passengers have checked in. If there's any spare tickets available, then the staff are allowed to have staff travel tickets, which you've still got to pay for. Mm-hmm. And you've also got to pay all the taxes and all the airport fees. So it's not as exciting as people think it is, considering that you haven't got a firm ticket at all and you could get chucked off at the last second if someone comes along and wants a seat. I went there and the guy said, it's overbooked by 20%. Now, this is a 777 out of Manila Airport to go back to Dubai, and a guy says, it's 20% oversold, and it's about 2 hours out. And I'm going, are you kidding?
Is that a computer problem?
No. But they knew on this particular day...
they want to do the overbooking
because they know
there'll be a fallout.
People fall out. Mm. And so he says, oh, yeah, it's a Monday. They always don't come on a Monday. And you're going, you've got to be kidding me. But they know that, and so they use the historical information on years and years worth of flights that on this flight on a Monday afternoon, traditionally people don't front up to the airport, and for that reason they overbook the flight.
But sometimes they're
wrong. They're wrong, and sometimes it's very rare that they're wrong. I mean, they do this professionally. That's what they do for a living. They've got guys, you know, ladies and gentlemen who are sitting there planning this every day for each flight. Mm. You know, a very, very small amount of times it goes wrong.
Weather predictors and predictions, they can get it wrong.
So there's that part of it. And so for you as a passenger, it's transparent to you, but ticketing has meant that your planes are fuller. Mm. In the old days, you used to be able to get a seat beside you with no one on.
That's
now
right.
There's always a person
but how
there.
Expensive was it to fly?
That's right.
Years ago.
So I lived in Sydney in 1980, and I used to catch a plane from Sydney to Melbourne for $287 was a return ticket to Sydney. Yeah. I can do that now. That was 1980. Mm-hmm. In 2019, I can do that flight for the same price in real dollars because we've gone through this amazing transition. So there's that transparency of the ticketing. It's mm-hmm. now electronic, and it costs them nothing to issue the ticket, but they charge you. How is this, Jetstar? You have to pay for a ticket to be issued to you, even though there's no ticket. Are you telling me?
You have to do a lot of work yourself these days if you fly. I mean, I suppose in the future, well, you will actually be doing the security yourself, won't you? You have to walk in like the mirror maze of, you know, technological
So that's
armory.
Why I tell people, you know, get yourself a travel agent, because a travel agent still gets paid on commission from the airlines. Travel agents do all that stuff, so you don't have to do all that stuff, and let them do all that stuff. Make sure, tick all the boxes and make sure the visas and passports and everything else is done like that.
But a travel agent can't prevent your luggage going missing.
And that's a funny thing. You know, we used to have an Ansett. We used to lose about 900 bags a month would go missing. 900 bags a month out of a million passengers, that's what the deal was. And so that bag's going around the world, you know, all around Australia, missing. And so we brought in this fantastic barcode baggage system, and it's now standard all around the world. So we know exactly whereabouts that part on the airplane, where that ticket is, where that bag is. Mm-hmm. So if a person doesn't check in, we've got to get the bag off because it might have a bomb in it, right? So 20 minutes before departure, we've pulled the pin, that's it. If they're not on the airplane, bags come off because it takes us that long to get the bag.
So it's got the barcoding, so how can people lose their bags? We still do, don't we?
And we did that. We put barcoding on an Ansett flights. Guess what? 900 a month still. And there are people who still lose their bags every time. And
What's the idea behind that?
The only thing I could put it down to is that when they've checked in, they've been not very nice to the person, and the person has checked them in and they've gone passenger to Cairns, baggage to Perth.
No. So this is a human factor.
Oh, it's a human factor. Must be. I mean, how you know somebody. I mean, everyone knows somebody who is just the baggage guru. Like, I know a particular family relative of mine. Whenever she comes back to Australia, she expects that Qantas is going to be driving a little van from the airport 1 or 2 days later bringing her bag back, because she checks everything by herself on computer. She doesn't use a travel agent. She thinks she's so clever. She can do it on the internet. But when you buy a ticket from an IATA travel agent, they build in an international gap. So if you're at an international airport and you're going from one plane to another, they will make sure that there is a 90-minute connection. Mm-hmm. No less. Not 89 minutes, not 85 minutes. So
it's very precise.
So your bags will connect. You might be there for 4 hours or five hours, but you won't be there less than 90 minutes because they're not allowed to book a ticket, which won't connect. So you go and do it yourself and you think you're really fantastic and you bank all these really fantastic connections, and what happens? Your bag doesn't connect. And then you get upset to the airline. Yeah. Why would you do that?
That's it. Also, I've had a situation, like I have had baggage, there's at least one, I remember, a bag went missing when I landed in Heathrow. And another time at the airport, somebody was picking up my bag and I was picking up their bag. And also, another time when I went through security, it's very quite interesting, but like I had a bottle of champagne and that went missing.
And it went through. Funny about that.
Yeah,
that's probably the pilots took that.
No, it was on the security belt in security as I'd landed, and I thought that's a little bit. I was quite upset actually because I was in security going through security, and somehow they couldn't help me recover the bottle of champagne. But actually, I did eventually because I went upstairs, went to the counter, and somebody had handed it in.
Yeah. If a pilot had stolen it, you would never have seen it again. The flight attendant sitting in the bus on the way to the hotel, hey, you've got a free bottle of champagne. What a tip, you know. But there's lots of changes that are all transparent to the customer, to the passenger, and they are things like those big firefighting vehicles that we see at the airport. You know, they've got those amazing fire trucks that can they turn out within 2 minutes of a plane crash, and they knock down a fire. They can pretty much within 5 minutes they've knocked down any sort of airplane.
We've still got people. We haven't got robots for that.
But they're using robots. So we used to put those guys in the silver. Yeah, we used to. It's true. We used to put the guys in the silver suits, and they'd get out there with the big fire hoses. And now they just drive these vehicles right up to the plane, and they use a robot and a handset from inside, and they can direct the nozzle, which is above the fire.
This
truck.
This is the garbage trucks.
Yeah, same
of
thing.
The airline maintenance industry. Yeah, on the tarmac.
They still have a lot of firemen because they've got to rescue the passengers, and they might have to cut through the plane and whatever. But when they first go up to an airplane, no one will be getting out of the airplane, out of the fire trucks. And they'll use five fire trucks and they'll just go around it and they'll...
But isn't it interesting? You said, oh, there'll still be people around. And, you know, even with train travel, you know, you're on the platform and sometimes there's just no way you can find another human being to help.
Yeah.
And
I recommend...
People do disappear.
Yeah, you should move. No, I'd move to Albert Park, you know, because we... whatever train... platform you're on, you should move to one where there's those guys, what do you call them, the police people, you know, that look after you. You need to be at a railway station with people.
Oh, so there's still people at Albert Park. Those people need to be protected.
We don't have a train. We use trams in Albert Park.
Electric
vehicles. I've got an electric vehicle. But it's, we can do all of that with, but they're still using the same number of people, but they're just in better jobs, in air conditioning. And so you've got those firemen. There's still the same number of firemen, but they're doing the job using equipment. And a lot of those positions now, they're using cameras and they're using drone technology. And so they're checking stuff out without having to go out in the weather. Not so much here in Australia, but in the Northern Hemisphere, when we're talking winter in Canada and
Moscow.
Nobody
wants to go up there.
You know, the snow and the de-icing of these aircraft. And we're talking, you know, thousands of airplanes taking off, like 2,000 airplanes every night take off out of America and go to Europe. And about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and if it's snowing on the eastern seaboard, they have to de-ice every one of those planes. And if there's people in those little cabins or those machines, well, they used to be standing out in the weather. Now they're located inside these little cabins. And they've got robots now that work out the distance between the nozzle and the wing so that we don't damage the airplane with the machinery. And so there's AIs helping in all those areas. Still maybe not stealing the jobs, but they're making the people safer who are doing the jobs. So there's less chance of a person, you know, getting blown over or getting damaged by an airplane engine because they're in a contained area now. And so there's lots of changes that AI that are saving people's lives or making their work conditions better.
That's
and
right.
Safer.
And there'll be people employed in the industry of drones. And do you see, has there been a lot of problems with drones in aerospace?
Huge. And it's the biggest thing for CASA this year and last year has been the number of drone operators in Australia are becoming registered, so people doing real estate agents work or pretty much every house. house that's up for sale for this next spring season, they're doing a complete drone survey. And so that, you know, now when you look at a house, if it hasn't got a drone picture, you really don't want to buy the house. But, you know, who is ever going to need a picture from your house from above? Because really you can't get up there and look at it. So but that's what everyone wants. So every real estate agent is now employing a drone operator. Mm-hmm. But pipeline inspectors, power line inspectors, they're now using drones. The Formula One now is using drones instead of helicopters, thank God. So it's not the noise of the helicopters. We can just put a drone up at each corner and they can just sit there filming high-definition TV all day without making any noises like the helicopters.
So the air traffic control towers have to also look after the drones flying through the space?
And you can't be closer than 5.5 kilometres from an airport and fly a drone. So this means that we've actually got to have people who say they're going to have drones flying people to and from the airport, from the city to the airport. Like, I don't think so. And so that also means that we've got to keep people away from the airports who are using drones and public events and people. I'm involved in motorsport and rallying, and in a forest when we have doing the media for an Australian Rally Championship, we'll have one or two drone operators who are legally allowed to be filming the event. But what happens if some guy goes out and says, oh, I want to see the cars,
amateur ones,
chucks his own drone out. And you can buy these things in post offices now.
Your children get them as presents.
There's hundreds of thousands of drones out there now, and very, very few people know about the rules of them.
So what are major changes, like for you personally, disrupted the workplace for you in terms of technology, innovation and use?
Electronic books. We used to have manuals for, well, they do have manuals for every aeroplane. And for an A380 captain, you're going to have 12 manuals for the previous company I worked for. So there's 12 manuals that you had to know, of which six of those manuals you pretty much had to memorize. And the flight crew operation manual for an A380 is now 9,312 pages. That's one manual. Now, when they printed them in paper, the manuals weren't that thick. Mm. So it made me realize that if it's infinite, if they just say, oh, we'll give them all an electronic book, they're going to read that, that doesn't stop them. So they, you know, there's all this stuff that you have to read now because it's easy for them to produce it. But if you said to them, sorry, you've got 500 pages, make it worth it, they would maybe write the manuals a bit better and differently.
Mm. And you're obliged, you know.
You're meant to memorise this stuff. And they change it all the time, so they're making all these amendments. So
Is that because there are problems with some of the planes, or is there so many changes happening?
Because people who sit at computers in their offices, they feel that they've got to produce something. And so every day, every week, someone sitting in a computer.
This is job creation.
It's job creation. So they've got to do something. So they go to their job and say, what shall I do today? And their boss says, well, why don't we change the way they do this? So there's all this change management going on at any time, which pilots find it quite interesting because the airplane doesn't know there's been a change and it still flies the same way it did last Thursday. But now you've got to use new words or different ways of doing things so that you don't offend people or you've got to be politically correct or something. And so that means that you've got to try and get your head around all this change, and that's the worst part, because they've made the job difficult and it's more of a legal job than an inspirational flying job where you used to just love flying.
In terms of being in the cockpit with all the controls, in your time when you were flying, were you less sort of manually active? Did it become different because the number of computers increased, and did you actually have to press less controls at different times?
Not really, no? But the number of controls are the same, and once you turn the autopilot on, it's it's pretty much the same whether it's the old-fashioned or the new type aeroplanes. The difference is the mental gymnastics, whereas when you've got one computer screen that can show you 12 different pages, then you've got this huge mental worry about, you know, am I on the right page? Where is it? Where is it now? What's it doing now? Am I looking at the right page? How do I get there? I know where that is. Whereas in the old days, they didn't have all those pages that are hidden from you. You just look there and there was the gauge, the big round gauge. Mm. And then right next to it, another big round gauge. The amount of information on a PFD, which is the primary flight display in front of the pilot now, you cannot imagine the amount of stuff that you can grab from
there. Could you imagine in the future, could it be a bit like Minority Report or something where you just see it in different layers and you can pull it to yourself? Because the way it is now with an e-book and you've got to go through a directory to get something to pull it out, that is a little bit slow in some ways. And you've got to have a different sort of memory and a different abilities. But I suppose in the future they might build information that you can read that you could bring to yourself more easily.
Why are we still using keyboards. Why are we using keyboards? You know, because keyboards, and funnily enough, you know, the keyboards are designed for women's hands. So
really?
Yeah, so that's why every second man's got a gangway.
That's why men want women's hands.
So, because for men to use a keyboard, they have to twist their hands into. So we've got all these men have got this ganglion and their problems with their typing, and women can type much faster because they've been doing it for.
And it wouldn't encourage men to learn how to type either.
They don't. So so we now have we've got a problem with older men who just don't get with the keyboard thing.
That's right. And the iPhones have been very difficult, especially the smaller versions for men, you know, with like, you know, large hands.
The button size is not big enough.
Yeah.
And so we're developing things like Siri and Alexa, where you can actually ask the question you need answered, especially in a document where you've got 9,000 pages to get through.
And did you used to use that function?
No, we didn't have it in those days, but we would do keyword searches, and you would search for a keyword if you wanted to find it. But it was interesting because as I was hiring from the industry, I'm still from the paper-based technology. So I would remember where on the page the paragraph I wanted was.
Exactly.
And I'd be looking on the left-hand side looking for a page.
Whereas you're using the first a visual officers, imprint.
Yeah, and that's where I'm looking. I can flick through 800 pages and I know exactly where I'm looking. Whereas the first officers, they don't even try. They just go straight to the search function and type the word. And they've got it.
It's automatic. They're wired differently.
Yeah, they're wired completely differently. So in the future, we're going to use a fast way of achieving it is by asking and get rid of that stupid keyboard completely.
And now they have, what was it, recently I read, an iPad where it's foldable. So.
Yeah, and then you look at Drag and Dictate. I don't know if you've been to a specialist doctor, but overseas I've seen doctors' studios in offices in Dubai where after the consultation, the doctor picks up a phone and he dials a number and then he says everything into the phone that he would normally have written and then hands the phone up. And of course now in every department of the hospital, anyone can access.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. That voice is then transcribed into data and then the data is kept.
And 2 seconds later, anyone from any other department can grab that and get the actual word from the person who wrote it or spoke it, and it's accurate and it's always correct, and you don't have any problems with illegible writing or people forgetting to fill it in or putting the wrong patient's data in, because he doesn't let you go until he's finished talking into the machine about you. And you, if it's wrong, you go, "Hey mate, are you sure? You said my left leg fell off," you know. And so we're seeing those changes in some departments, and it's like in legal and medical, but it's just got to get further in the community.
Okay, we'll be back.
Are you getting the IT support your business deserves and needs? Intutech is proud to provide fast, friendly support to businesses in the Bayside area and beyond. With computer sales, email, internet, virus protection, backup solutions, and more, Intutech is your one-stop IT shop. Mention this announcement for a free, no-obligation health check of your business, valued at over $300. Call Intutech now on 1-300-765-911.
Southern FM sponsor.
I'm Peter Hitchener. More than 288,000 Australians right now have hearing and sight impairments. Imagine if you could not see and also not hear. Able Australia is helping many Australians living with deaf blindness. You can help too. Visit ableaustralia.org.au. That's ableaustralia.org.au or call 1300 225 369. 1300 225 369.
From Paran to Parkdale, you're listening to Southern FM.
There have been a lot of changes that have affected the airline industry. If we look at electric propulsion, have you got any comments on that, James?
Well, yeah. In fact, Airbus had they're trying to make an aeroplane. In fact, one flew over the English Channel the other day. Airbus have designed the first plane that flew over the English Channel using electric propulsion. And they're sticking one engine, electric engine, in a BA-146 and using that as a flying test bed, because that's really important to see how it performs in terms of temperature and altitude and
speed. Go to give us a definition, it's like, is it piston power that gives way to turbine power? How else does this work?
It just spins like a jet engine. And so it looks like a jet engine and it spins and basically works like a big propeller, because the front fan of a jet engine is making a large amount of thrust like a propeller. And so it's the same sort of thing. And the guy was saying that they're going to not only have electric engines, They'll have maybe two electric engines and two normal engines. So you won't be seeing full electrified planes going around in the future. You'll be seeing ones that are sort of hybrids.
Mm.
And so they might be able to use the electric when they're up in the cruise, and they may be using the fossil fuels to get yourself off the ground.
That's right. So that's the next technology that has been changing the industry, biofuels. So what's the update on this?
Well, the update is that to fuel the Lufthansa fleet with biofuels made from grains, they would have to get rid of all the houses and the buildings and concretes, and the whole area of Germany would have to be turned into farms to make biofuels just for one airline.
But how many flights would that include?
Well, lots. But the problem is that you wouldn't have any people to fly them, because they wouldn't be living in Germany, because they'd all be farmers working for the biofuel company. So it's going to be a hybrid. It's going to help. Bits and pieces are going to help. But, you know, it's not the big fix for everything. Although algal blooms able to reproduce really, really quickly. And they're looking now at using algae to get you the biofuel energy rather than grains.
And
if that works, well, then there's a big
doesn't take
changer.
Up as much land?
Doesn't, well, it's out in the sea. It's out in the ocean.
So using our resources.
We could use the sea resources to make algae, and you could probably, or big lakes or whatever, and it reproduces very quickly.
And what about autonomous flight? Are we there yet?
Well, that's like drone flying. And when I used to fly into Iraq from Emirates, I used to fly into Basra and to Baghdad and also to Erbil. Every now and then as you're going in, you'd be listening to other pilots and you'd hear these 1.5 second, 2 second delay from a controller would ask a pilot, and the pilot would take a few seconds to reply. That's because you knew he was actually in Nevada flying a drone, and you're actually going past a drone. You could see them on the on the TCAS. You could say there's another aeroplane, but the pilot is in Nevada.
Wow.
So, yeah, they're out there now. The big question is, and, you know, why not? You know, why not have one pilot who's flying five planes at once? Because all he's really needed for is a takeoff and landing.
And would you fly in a pilotless plane?
Well, that's the question. We're talking about passengers. So in terms of cargo planes and in terms of military planes, I can see there's a great benefit. But there's nothing better than watching the passengers when they get on the plane, they see the pilot. And they size you up in a hundredth of a second, which is why you want to wear the silly hat and the uniform, because that's what they're buying. They're buying an image of safety.
Oh, yeah.
They're buying the pilot. They want a pilot to look like a pilot.
But mind you, the people who are passengers now do seem to dress more casually than they used to. It used to be very glamorous to fly, but now people turn up in pyjamas.
That's exactly. Well, and less.
But not the pilots.
No, not the pilot. Well, we wear pyjamas in our crew rest compartments, but my grandfather would be rolling in his grave. I mean, this is a man who used to get dressed in a tweed jacket and pants to go down to the city, on a train. Mm. He would never, and that era, they would not believe the sort of passengers we get on aeroplanes today.
Times have changed. Now, our passport photos have changed. We're not allowed to smile. We're not allowed to display any teeth, not for signs of aggression or anything, but not for even, smiling or friendliness. So biometrics, how's that changing the industry?
Well, the De Beers Airport, Maktoum Airport, which is now going to it's the next big airport in the world. It's the first airport that's been designed after 9/11, and it's been especially designed to have a document-free airport. So this airport will be biometrics only, paper-free airport, and no security gates. So when you go along on a walkway,
is it facial recognition?
There's all of that, but you'll put your bag in another little walkway beside you, and as you're going along the walkway, it's going to be scanned for everything. So, and it'll be scanned many, many times. So there's no need for a stop and search security because it's all done before.
And some people might really find that a huge advantage.
Of course, there's no need for us to stand there and look at someone when you're checking in. They can do all that for you.
And connectivity and entertainment, what changes can we expect?
Well, Emirates has been the leader of that with their ISIS system, which has 2,000 channels of connectivity, and for many years has been using telephone and internet in the aeroplanes, except in a few places in the world. One of them, Australia, and the other one, India.
And why is that?
Because Telstra wouldn't allow for them to use it in Australia. And so for many, many times, people would be using the internet on the Emirates aeroplanes, and then coming into Australia's airspace, suddenly Clunker gets turned off. Mm. Same going over India. Well, now that's sort of been changed now, so pretty much you can use connectivity anywhere in the world on high-value aeroplanes like Emirates aeroplanes. And I think it's funny, I think Delta in America, this is how far behind they are.
Yeah, there's an Indian airline.
The Delta's...
Delta
America is talking about using email. Hello. I mean, Emirates gives you free internet for sending emails for a certain amount of emails. It's free for every passenger. Mm. And then you've got to pay $5 if you want to use your internet during the flight.
And people can make calls up in the air?
They never do. You know, they've always been able to make calls for a long, long time, but it's funny that no one makes calls and you never hear a phone go off in an airplane. Mm-hmm. You know, since SMS has come in, you can sit there and SMS all your friends. Pretty much all you want to tell is your partner when you're going to be there and when to pick you up.
Yeah.
And if you want to search your flight number, if you're going on EK407
yeah.
or 406 arriving tomorrow morning, you just put EK406 into mm-hmm. Google. Mm-hmm. It'll tell you exactly when that plane's landing, any airline. So that's something that anyone can do. So there's no need to worry about having to ring your loved one and tell them when to.
And what was your favourite flight path as a pilot?
I think Melbourne. I think... it's back home, you know, and after having lived away for 13 and a half years, my last flight was to Melbourne and back again, back to Dubai. I think, you know, that's where it all started for me, and it's coming home. It's always the best destination.
And it is a beautiful city. And why is it a beautiful city? I'm asking.
Well, why is Melbourne the best? I think it's... Well, because the bay... Bayside is fantastic, which is why we're here on Southern FM.
Southern FM.
But this city is also growing up, and it's a big, big, tall city now. You know, there's not very many tall cities in America. Most cities, like Oklahoma, they've only got two skyscrapers. Mm-hmm. So there's not very many big cities in the world, and Melbourne looks like a big city now.
What in technology excites you?
I'm excited about my new car. It's fantastic. It only costs $27,000. But the thing is, it's got so much technology in it that you don't get in and drive. Any of these new cars, it takes you about 30 seconds before the car lets you go anywhere because it has to check itself out and it's got all these fantastic sensors.
What sort of frightens you or what are you fearful of in terms of technology for the future?
I don't think I'm scared about anything, really.
Is that because you've been a captain?
I don't break the law. Well, I don't break the law. I think if you're a bad person, I think you've got to be worried about technology because I don't think there's anywhere to hide. You know, in Dubai, there's 70% of the police in Dubai are plainclothes. You don't see police on the streets, and they've got lots of cameras, and they always get their man, just like the Canadian Mounties.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, they're always very good at getting their people, and mm-hmm. I think that's because there's a lot of CCTV cameras.
Yeah, okay, so you're not afraid because you know.
And I think they had the Victorian police used the Victorian police to help them with a traffic problem in mm-hmm. Dubai. They had very high speeds and a lot of car crashes. Mm-hmm. The Victorian police went over there and they taught them what to do. They taught them cameras. And their dream is to have a camera every kilometre on those roads.
Mm. But what's that like, you know, as a citizen that you're always constantly watched? I mean,
you're on show. You say to yourself, I'm not going to pay tax. A tax for idiots. Mm. So I don't want to pay these people. Mm. So I put cruise control in and I don't break the speed limit.
No. So there's nothing that scares you about technology. I mean, you're not that keen on some aspects of AI or you question how we're going to use some of this technology. Is that one thing that you're fearful of, that we don't actually use technology?
I'm fearful about managers who don't know how to manage it. And they are, what we've got to do is we've got to not worry about AI. We've got to worry about email. Because the definition of management is getting work done through other people. But you can't get work done when you're being sent emails from all these different departments.
That's right. People like email because they say, oh, I've done something and it's on record. But, you know, there are even some tech companies that ban email use with workers.
Well, I think what we have to do is we have to train our managers to protect their staff. Your job is the gatekeeper, to let your people do their job. And it means that you're going to stop all these other departments bamboozling people with email.
That's right. And do you think that if there had been a different sort of management in, you know, the last part of your career as a pilot, do you think that you would have been able to manage change better, or you think you would have at least enjoyed that part of your work.
Yeah, I think as I got older and towards the end of my career, it made it easier to walk away, because you'd be going down the runway at 300 kilometres an hour, which is the most dangerous thing you can do, and you've got to make a split-second decision whether we're going to live or die and rescue this aeroplane with 570 people on board. We've got to get this right. And all you'd be saying to yourself is, oh, thank God we're out of there, you know, because there's so many legal requirements and so many documents that you've got to sign for and so many emails and changes you've got to try and keep your head around every day. And I'd really like to have management, all management, say to yourself, my job as a manager is to protect my people from everyone harassing them with emails.
And this is something that it could be in any industry, not just the industry that you're involved in. Before you were a pilot, you had mentioned earlier when we were speaking that you had experience as an actor. I wanted to know whether or not there are any skills that were transferable in the life of a pilot.
Well, it is an acting job. You know, to be a captain of an airliner is an acting job, really, because the actual skills of being a pilot, not too hard.
You have to play the part, make sure you put that uniform properly.
But passengers are buying, you know, it's a selling thing.
Okay.
Passengers are buying a ticket and they want to see the cabin crew look fantastic and they want
to be
look
confident.
And the pilots
sound
have
confident.
To look like they're confident.
Yeah.
You know, and so whether you use your voice doing a PA, whether they see you in your uniform, they want to get their money's worth. And it's funny how even my sister, if she'd see me in uniform, she'd go, oh, I love a man in uniform. It's funny how the number of people, they love a man in uniform, but they don't come up and talk to you. So, like, you walk through an airport with your crew, and they're all, and in a lot of Asian airports,
it's intimidating for some people, I guess.
They take photos. So if you walk through an airport in China or Japan or in Korea, any Asian airport, and you walk through those the 26 Emirates girls in front of you, and they'd say, oh, look at that captain. Isn't he nice that he's walking behind them? You know, he's following them and looking after them. It's not true. It's because if I can fly from Dubai all the way to Beijing and I can find it, which is pretty impressive because it's on the other side of the planet, but I can't find the bus.
You have to follow.
I've no
have
idea
to follow
where the
other
bus
people.
So you, because they always know. There's always one who's
oh,
from
that's
there.
Interesting. Yeah,
and
that
they and you just follow
that.
Them and they go, oh look, aren't they? Isn't that Captain Nice? He's being nice and looking after his staff. Not so. And so people actually take photos. In fact, I'm in thousands of photos.
What about the
in
film?
People's houses.
What about the film? I do quite like it. Catch Me If You Can.
Yes.
I can see some screenshots there in
that's
my mind.
Right. Well, that's what it's like. And so, and there are a few airlines that make a thing about we walk through the airport together, and Emirates is one of them. That's the image of the airline, and it looks, you know, looks fantastic.
Tech news of the day, Dell laptops catch fire. So on August the 14th, 2006, Dell and Sony admit the flaws in the Sony-manufactured batteries that were used in the certain Dell laptops that could result in batteries overheating and catching fire or exploding. So there was a recall of over 4.1 million batteries, the largest computer-related recall in history. News headlines. Boeing to change 737 MAX flight control software to address flaw sources. Boeing co-plans further changes to the software architecture.
Well, we thought that the MAX would be fixed with a software change. We really hoped that was going to happen and happen fast. But unfortunately, the FBI's got involved in that investigation and that's going to slow everything right up. And they've also now said there's more problems with the 737 MAX. We'd hoped it was going to be flying in September, October. Sadly, I think it'll be until January, February before it flies again.
Two drunk United Airline pilots arrested at Glasgow Airport before the flight. Is this something that you've seen a lot of?
Not very much, but it does happen. It's happened, I think, my old airline has a captain who's living in a jail in England. It does happen. It's pretty impressive that they are onto it. And in most airlines now, we have random testing for alcohol and drugs. And we all, you know, have been tested quite a number of times. When you sign on for work, it just tells you that you've been selected. But for one of the roles of the security people, when we go through security at the airports, they are to check us as well. And so that's how they pick these guys up. So they go through security, they smell them for alcohol, and then they press the button.
Ryanair strikes. Brit holiday makers hit with further chaos as pilots vote for 5 days of strike action in dispute over pay.
Yeah, this is going to be big. This is going to be big because Ryanair is closing a lot of branches They've had a really bad summer.
Because it's one time when they were doing so well.
Yeah,
I suppose,
I think they've got a 737 MAX problem, but also things have been going badly for them, and they're closing some branches and cutting back. So people are going to lose their jobs.
Thank you very much for the flight, ex-Captain James Nixon.
My pleasure.
We've had a great landing. And I'd like to thank you for your company here on Tech Load. Join me, Sandra Spencer, on Southern FM next week with more tech news, info and experts. Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m.